This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
This morning, we're going to conclude the series that we've been studying, which surveys the life of these two great figures in the Old Testament, Elijah and Elisha. And so far, for the first 4 weeks, we've taken a look at specific passages concerning Elijah and Elisha. And in this morning, as we conclude this series, I want to do something a little bit different. I want to survey the entire section of 1 and 2 Kings, and there are the references for you for your own personal reading. I want to kind of survey this, all of this material, and in particular, compare and contrast these two characters along a number of different lines. And I want to do that not just out of some academic interest, but because I think that's going to take us, it's going to introduce us to a couple of very important lessons that all of us need to learn. But let's begin with a comparison of Elijah and Elisha, and let's begin with the similarities between these two men. Both of them, as we have seen, were not only prophets of God or inspired spokesmen for the God of the Bible, who were raised up to speak His word and His will in a specific historical context, but they were in fact both the lead prophets of their day in the northern kingdom of Israel in the 9th century BC, which was a time of crisis when the spiritual welfare of Israel hung in the balance. Both of them were empowered by God in what we would have to call extraordinary ways. That is to say that their prophetic ministry was characterized by miracles in a way that was not normal with the other prophets of the Old Testament. In fact, except for Moses, who was in many ways Israel's first prophet, and except for Jesus Christ, God's own son, no other figures in the entire Bible perform as many miracles as Elijah and Elisha. So they have something in common on that as well. Both of them, as you saw last week through Rick's teaching, had the same key ministry priority. Namely, that they spent a lot of time and effort training a guild of prophets, a group of young men who were known as the sons of the prophets, who believed in the one true God and who were being raised up and developed to carry on this prophetic ministry, which included the recording of what we now call the Old Testament. That was a key commonality in their ministry priorities. And both of them had very unusual departures from this life. Last week, if you were here, then you know that Elijah did not die physically. He was actually taken away into the presence of God by a fiery chariot. It was one more way that signified God's hand and God's authority and God's calling on Elijah's life. And Elisha also had an unusual circumstance surrounding his departure. We read in 2 Kings 13 that he died, like most all of us do. But that when he had died and was buried, a man was thrown hastily into his grave. And we're told that when that man's corpse touched the bones of Elisha, he came to life. And this is not common even in the Old Testament. And it was another way in which God signified the special call that lay on this man and that he was endowed with the spiritual life of God. It's also a foreshadowing, I think. Their departures were both foreshadowings of the coming of Jesus Christ, who is God's prophet, God's spokesman par excellence, and who overcame death for all of us through his resurrection. So much for the similarities. What I think may be more instructive for us are the differences between these two men. Some of the differences were just basic, even constitutional differences. They came from very different backgrounds. Elijah came from Gilead, which was the sticks, the rural part of, it was Israeli Appalachia. I hope I don't offend anyone. I'm sure he thought it was his favorite part of the country as well. But he was from Tishbite, which we can't even, Tishba, which we can't even locate anymore. There are no remains. It was so small. On the other hand, Elisha, we're told, came from more Israel central. And he, unlike Elijah, who was probably pretty poor, he came from a wealthy background. And we infer this from the fact that in 1 Kings 19, when we meet Elisha, he's driving a team of 12 oxen, which signified considerable wealth during this time. So there's socioeconomic differences here. When we think about their personalities, Elijah was extremely volatile in his moods. He was up and down. He was capable of great elevation of mood and capable of going deep into the depths of depression. They're pretty wide. His emotional life seemed to be like more roller coaster-ish. Whereas Elisha seems to be a more even-tempered man. We don't see the same presence of those swings in his emotional life. He was more of a stabilizing factor, which had to do with his distinctive role. Well, even in physical appearance, Elijah, we're told, was hairy, a hairy man, while Elisha was bald. And here, I personally think Elisha got the better deal, although you may not agree. Even more interesting are the differences between these men's ministries. Even though there was great continuity or similarity in what they were called to do, yet within that commonality, there were striking differences. Elijah, on the one hand, Elisha supersedes Elijah. His ministry was over three times as long as Elijah. Elijah was like a shooting star. Lit up the whole sky, but he wasn't there that long. But by contrast, Elisha had a slow burn. 50 years, as many as 50 years serving in this role. First mentored by Elijah as a contemporary and then carrying on afterwards. Exactly twice as many miracles are recorded as being performed by Elisha than by Elijah. And some people think that this is part of God's answer to Elisha's request in 2 Kings 2 that he would receive a double portion of Elijah's spirit. I'm not so sure that that's accurate, but there's no doubt about the fact that he did double the miracles. Elijah was a truly public figure. And what dominated his ministry as a prophet of God was directly confronting world powers. You meet him storming into Ahab's office, who's the president of the whole country and a power broker in the ancient Near East. You see him confronting Ahab's wife Jezebel. You see him confronting Ahab's son, who is also a great king. He's a larger than life figure that just kind of towers above everyone else. And he's always in people's faces. Elisha, on the other hand, although he had some dealings with public figures, mainly worked with the common people. And most of what we learn about his ministry has to do with working with people whose names were not even recorded, whose names we'll never know this side of heaven. So he was a man of the common folk. Elijah's miracles were usually dramatic, and they usually had a judgmental function. We covered this in previous weeks. Elijah is the one who stops the rain by God's authority and causes a drought. Elijah is the one who calls down fire from heaven to expose Baal as a false god. Elijah is the one who starts the rain again. Most of his miracles were very public, very spectacular, and usually with an element of disciplinary judgment on the nation because of its departure from the one true God. By contrast, Elisha's miracles were usually very modest, and they were primarily restorative in nature. For example, he one time cleansed the waters by Jericho because they were foul. At another point, he saved a widow from financial ruin by multiplying her cooking oil. He detoxified some stew for a group of men. He fed 100 men who were on a mission by multiplying the grain that they'd brought with them. He cured a leper, a Gentile leper. And he made an axe head float so that it could be recovered by a work crew who was loaning it. And this being early in the Iron Age, axe heads would have been very precious, and it would have ruined the man who borrowed it to have lost it. So his miracles were usually quiet, behind the scenes, and mainly restorative to people. A lot of people point out, and I think they're right, that Elijah and Elisha typify the second and first comings of Jesus, respectively. Elijah's miracles are public, dramatic, and judgmental. And this is exactly what we read about the second coming of Jesus. Elisha's miracles are quiet, behind the scenes, and restorative. And this is exactly the tone of Jesus' miracles in his first coming, when he came to save that which was lost. So the tenor, the nature of their miraculous ministry was very different. Elijah, again, towers above every other figure except for Moses in the Old Testament. When you think about the New Testament's references to these two men, the New Testament explicitly mentions Elijah 29 times and alludes to him many other times beyond that. Elisha receives only one reference by Jesus in Luke 4. To sum it up, Elijah, as I said, is a larger-than-life figure. He's famous in his own right. He's a magnetic figure that everyone's drawn to. Whereas throughout his ministry, throughout his life, Elisha lived in the shadow of Elijah. Long after Elijah had passed from the scene, when there was a need for a prophet and someone mentioned Elisha, he was known even after Elijah's death as the one who used to pour water on the hands of Elijah. In other words, as a servant, the one who served Elijah, the one who ministered to Elijah, the one who carried out many of the directives given by God to Elijah. Elisha's ministry was largely executing or carrying out the marching orders that God had given to Elijah. He lived in his shadow for his entire life. Now, this is where I think we can begin to reflect on these two men and the differences between them in a way that will be profitable for our own lives. Because most of you, I think probably all of you, like me, have lived various portions of your life in someone else's shadow. You know how it feels to be overshadowed by someone else. Certainly, we lived in our parents' shadows. And in coming to Christ, we often live in the shadow of other more experienced or more dramatically gifted Christian leaders and workers. Do you know how to handle that in a godly way? Do you know what it looks like to relate to someone who overshadows you in that sense? Or have you resented that and run away from that and felt like you have to get away from someone who overshadows you so you can be who you really are? Some of us have set our lives on fire by the way we related to those who overshadowed us. Most all of us will have people that live in our shadow for a period of time. People in whose lives we've been placed in ways that comparatively they're in our shadow. Do you know how to relate in a godly way to overshadowing someone else? Do you know what that looks like? This is something that I'm sure both Elijah and Elisha learned. They learned how to play these roles in a godly way, and the success, the effectiveness of their ministries, the reason why people still read about them with interest and learn from them today, was in part because they learned how to do this. And what we learn implicitly from their stories about how to do this, we can learn explicitly from other passages in the Bible, because the Bible has a lot to say about living in the shadow of another person or overshadowing someone else in a way that honors God. And that's a vast subject. What I want us to do is just to think about this in terms of two lessons that we can learn on this subject. And we can get at each of these lessons by raising a question about these two men. The first question is this: which one, Elijah or Elisha, was better suited to be a prophet? Who was better equipped to play the role that they were given to play during their period of history? Well, probably, if we're giving our instinctive answer rather than our correct answer, most of us would say, well, certainly it was Elijah. Elijah was more powerful. Elijah was more dramatic. Elijah was a mover and a shaker. And in comparison, Elisha, maybe he was behind the door to some extent when those gifts were handed out, and most of them went to Elijah instead. But that would be the wrong answer. The correct answer, according to God, is that they both were perfectly suited to play the roles that they were given to play. Elijah had to play an absolutely critical role during the height of this spiritual crisis, and so he was endowed, therefore, by God with the equipment in gifting and supernatural enablement and personality and all the others to stand in the gap when the storm was fiercest. Elisha lived just after that period of critical crisis when the key for the nation was spiritual stabilization. And he was equipped in similar ways then to be a reminder of the people of God's redemptive love for them and his concern for the small people and the small things of life, as well as for the big events and the public figures. The truth is that both of these men were fashioned by God exactly properly to play the role that he had given them to play. They were like the prophet Jeremiah. And we read that when God called Jeremiah, who came later than these men during another time of darkness, God said, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were ever born, I set you apart. I have appointed you as a prophet to the nations." What an amazing thing to be told as Jeremiah was called into a role during a very dark and dangerous time. With that call came this promise by God. Before you ever existed, I knew you and I had a role for you, and I fashioned you for the role that I'm about to call you to play. And what was true specifically of these three Old Testament prophets, the Bible tells us, is true of all of us. The lesson here is that God has fashioned each and every one of us for a unique role in His service. And that lesson is life-changing if it burns into your soul, and if you meet the living God who gives you this promise and give your life to Him. That the same God who fashioned Elisha and Elijah for their roles, the same God who fashioned Jeremiah long before he was born for his unique destiny in God's plan, the same God, we're told, does the same thing for each and every one of us, because this passage in Ephesians 2:10, the audience is as wide as those who respond to the call of God. We are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for significant accomplishments, which God prepared in advance for us to do. There's no way around it. The language here is a metaphor of God as a sculptor. God sculpting a masterpiece to put on display. God working before we were born to fashion us for our time and place in history to play a role that no one else can play. A role of significant accomplishments for Him and the advancement of His kingdom. What does that involve? In what ways has God fashioned you and me? Now, this is a mysterious area because on the one hand, we live in a broken world, broken by sin and rebellion, and we are broken people. And so we're all marred, we're all broken, damaged goods, and we make wrong choices that damage us, and others can make wrong choices that damage us as well. But in what theologians call the providence of God, God somehow sovereignly and mysteriously is at work in ways that we sometimes just plain marvel at, to fashion us for the role, the unique role that He has for us. And it includes not only the natural talents that He has given you, but also the natural talents which He has not given you. The spiritual gifts that He's bestowed upon you and the spiritual gifts that He has withheld from you. The personality that you have is the personality that God gave you. Many of your physical qualities, including some that you don't like that well, were mysteriously part of God's fashioning for you. Many of the experiences of your past, not only wonderful experiences that you look back on in longing, but often experiences that were painful to you. Like when Joseph was able to say to his brothers who sold him into slavery decades before, "You meant that for evil, but God used it for good to advance His purpose." The key people that God has placed in your life, all this is part of His fashioning work. The specific time and place in which you find yourself in history is not an accident. The overarching, providential, sovereign fashioning of God, because God is both personal and infinite, He is able to carefully fashion each individual to play a role that no one else can play in this marvelous tapestry, which is the outworking of His purpose in human history. All that God says about each and every one of us. And this is a truth, this is a message that our culture is starving for. We live in a purpose-starved culture. Because we're made in the image of this God, there is something deep within the soul of every human being that aches for a purpose and to live our lives for a cause greater than ourselves. We live in a culture that through decades of attack on the existence of the God of the Bible, which has created a purpose vacuum for our whole culture. Through decades of atheistic existentialism, which told us that life is without ultimate meaning, so you have to make your own purpose through your own decisions. Here, the Eastern spiritualities are no better because God is not a person who calls and bestows a purpose on you. God is simply everything, and you are God, you are part of God. So again, you create your own purpose. In postmodern constructivism, we construct any meaning out of our lives that we hope to have. But it doesn't work. Because we were designed to be given a purpose by another person. And that's why we're turning into a culture of purpose voyeurs. We're a culture that's living out the Truman Show, where people are living vicariously by watching stories about other people in a way that's no longer are people reading stories and watching stories to be inspired to find their purpose for life. People are vicariously, as voyeurs, letting other people live life and purpose for them. The craze of so-called reality TV, which is anything but reality, and the incredible obsession by the viewership. What is it other than a symptom of a purpose-starved culture? Why was Lord of the Rings so fantastically popular? I think it's because that wonderful story, which is my favorite story of all time, apart from the Bible itself, is a wonderful spinning out of this truth here, that there is a grand purpose. And that God has called each of us into His quest, into His purpose. And that what life is about is following the purpose that is bestowed upon you by that other one. And a lot of people resonate deeply with that message, even though philosophically they don't believe in it. We live in a purpose-starved culture. But you cannot have true purpose unless there is an infinite personal God who gives you purpose. You can't have it any other way. And all self-generated purpose will be hollow and vacuous. And we're proving that like no other generation ever has. How do you discover the purpose for which you've been created? Well, you know, there's two good books. That's a whole series. That's a whole book. This is Rick Warren's The Purpose-Driven Life. It's very, very fascinating to me that this book is a runaway bestseller. This copy says over 10 million copies sold. I don't think it's all Christians that are buying this book. I think the very title of this book resonates in the hearts of people in our purpose-starved culture. And it's good. It's a good basic answer to that question. This book by Oz Guinness called The Call is, I think, a more in-depth treatment of this same subject, that each of us has called by God in a unique way to a unique role in His purpose. And I recommend both of them for you. Rick Warren's The Purpose-Driven Life, Oz Guinness's The Call. In the brief time that we have here this morning, I just want to give two of the most basic answers to this question. How can we discover the purpose for which God has fashioned us? The first is that you got to be reconciled to this God, the God who created you, the God who is personal and infinite, the God who speaks to you, the God who generates the only true purpose. You can't know the purpose of your life or discover how you've been fashioned for that purpose until you meet your Creator. And you can only meet your Creator through Jesus Christ, because only Jesus Christ paid the sin debt that you and I have both incurred against God through our rebellion, through our autonomy, through our rejection of His purpose, through our insistence on charting our own purpose. That's a real issue with God. That's called desertion, rebellion, treason. And it's a capital crime in God's court. And God, because He loved you, sent His Son to lay down His perfect life as a payment for your treason and for mine. And only when you come back to God through Jesus, acknowledging your rebellion against Him, acknowledging your guilt before Him, and asking His death to pay for your sins, only then are you reconciled with the One who gives you purpose. That's the ground floor. And I fear that for some of you here this morning, you're going to get the cart before the horse. You want to get more into the particulars of the way God has fashioned you before you get the basic foundational point. You got to know God. You got to establish a relationship with God and be accepted by Him. You got to become His child rather than an orphan estranged from Him. And you do that, but each of us do that one at a time. There's no group conversion. It's a turnstile, one at a time. Asking Christ to forgive you, asking Him to come into your life, bowing to God as your Creator and saying, now my life is yours. Now, along the way, once you receive Christ, as you begin to learn God's macro purpose through His Word, as you place yourself in the company of fellow servants of Christ in Christian fellowship, as you seek to share your faith in Christ with other people who do not know Him, along the way, over and over again, you're going to need to be willing to affirm to God the wisdom of His fashioning hand in your life. Because if you're like me, you'll find that at many points along the road, almost subconsciously, you are questioning or rejecting what God claims here, that I knew what I was doing when I made you the way that you are. Usually it comes by comparing ourselves to other fellow Christians. And I want to talk more about that in a few minutes. If only I had their gifts. If only I came to Christ at the age that they did. If only I had the childhood upbringing that that person did. If only I was allowed to have that opportunity. Then I could fulfill my purpose, my role for Christ. But since I haven't, then I can't. And when we think that way, and all of us think that way sometimes, some of us think that way virtually all the time, and especially when we think that way chronically, it leads to a controversy with God. That ironically is the thing that's most frustrating us from finding our role in God's plan. Frustration with God's fashioning hand usually indicates that we're pursuing the wrong purpose. Oh, this is painful. I remember some guy years ago when I was a young Christian hearing him say, when you complain about the way God fashioned you, it's usually because you've got the wrong agenda. And he said, you know what? Our lives are fashioned by God to be like a good picture frame. And a good picture frame has a purpose. Its purpose is to draw the viewer to the picture, not to the frame. And the picture is Jesus Christ. God, the purpose of our lives is to draw other people's attention to the beauty of Jesus Christ, to the love of Jesus Christ, to the goodness of Jesus Christ, so that they too can come and belong to Him and worship Him. And the problem is that I want to be the picture more than I want to be the frame. And this man asked me that question. He says, when you complain about how God made you Is it because you want to be the picture rather than the frame? Don't answer that question too glibly. The filth down in my heart, the sewage of my fallen nature, continues to impress me in the subtlety of ways that I insist stubbornly on being the picture rather than the frame. He went on to ask, if you could change certain things about yourself, and we've all got a laundry list, would it really be so that you could better glorify Christ? Or would it be so that you could glorify yourself and make your life easier? Ouch. Oh. When I was 22, I realized I was losing my hair. Oh, my God. And this was, you know, long enough ago that the cosmetic alternatives were pretty few and pretty expensive. And I remember really having to fight it out with God on that issue. Certainly, you didn't mean this. Certainly, I could better serve you without an artificial halo from the gleam on the top of my head. And you know, it may sound trite, it is humorous even to me in retrospect, but that was one of many issues that forced me to go back and ask these questions about myself. And what do I really want after all? Do I want to be the picture? Or do I realize and do I want to be that I'm the frame? And you can get a lot of mileage out of asking those two questions when you realize that you're frustrated and discontent with the way God fashioned you. The problem is not in the wisdom of God's fashioning hand. The problem is usually our own egos. And the resolution is to, in a deeper way, humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God, so that he may exalt us at the proper time. And even that means so that he may more effectively draw other people to himself through us. I think Elisha must have learned this lesson, or he could not have played the role that God gave him to play as effectively as he did. Now here's another lesson that's directly related, that flows from the first lesson, and we can get at that by a different question. Which of these two men was more successful as a prophet? The first question had to do with the equipment they were given. This is a slightly different question. Given that they were given different equipment by God's wisdom, which one was more successful in carrying out their unique role? And I suppose that their answer, and I suppose that our answer, will have everything to do with the audience that we consult. In Guinness's book, The Call, he has a tremendous chapter called The Audience of One. One, of course, referring to the God of the Bible. And he said, most of us, whether we're aware of it or not, do things with an eye to the approval of some audience or other. He goes on to say that only the most narcissistic megalomaniacs play to their audience of themselves. That's, you know, our culture may say that's mental health when you care only about pleasing yourself. That's the height of aberration and dysfunction, according to God. Most of us play out our lives to the audience of a few select people whose opinion we value as very important. And his point is that for most of us, then, the question is not whether we have an audience, but which audience we have. And the selection of our audience is absolutely critical when it comes to evaluating the success of your life and into determining the success of your life. If you know, even in Elijah and Elisha's day, the answer to the question would depend upon which audience. If you would have consulted mainstream Israeli society, they would have both said that these men were failures. Neither of these men made a lot of money. money. Neither one of them succeeded in gaining any political power. Neither one of them were willing to go along at all with the worship of Baal. And that's what the mainstream wanted the whole time. So if they're the audience, they were both failures. If the audience were those true followers of God during in Israel during this time, probably if you got an honest Gallup poll from them, they would have said Elijah was the more successful. Because again, he was the more dramatic, the more public, the more spectacular. Honest answers from the Christian community today would probably give us the same answer, that Elijah was the more successful. But if we consult the audience of one, the only audience whose opinion ultimately matters, I think that the answer again is they were both successful. And here's the lesson that can change your life, that success is fulfilling, faithfully fulfilling the role that God has for your life. That is success. Faithfully fulfilling the role that God has for your life. You know why that's success? Because God is the only one to whom all of us will ultimately give an account. And in that day, no other audience's opinion will matter at all. The challenge for us is to live by faith in a world where other audiences are screaming at us. To live by faith in the unseen audience of one. And to really believe on a day-to-day basis when we do little things that no one is watching as well as when we do big things, that this is what success is. This is the secret to true greatness. Not seeking our culture's approval. Boy, was Jesus ever a stickler on this? He says, you know what? What is highly valued among men, and by men he meant the mainstream. What is highly valued by the mainstream is usually detestable in the sight of God. So contradictory are the values of God's kingdom and the kingdoms of this world that he says you can almost count on the fact that if something is exalted and prized in your culture, God probably doesn't think too much of it at all. Jesus went so far as to say, woe to you when you're popular with everyone, because that's how their fathers treated the false prophets. Certainly this is true in our culture. Our culture is a culture that exalts transactional leaders, people who are excellent at reading the polls, discovering what most people want and playing it back to them with a spin that makes them feel okay, so that your popularity level rises. According to God, that's a complete pathetic failure as a leader. And Jesus said many times that when the audience of one evaluates, many who are first now will be last then. And conversely, many who are last now will be first then. Because of how different his values are. The value of finding the God of the Bible through Jesus Christ. The value of learning his word so that the mind of Christ becomes your perspective on life. The value of reaching lost people with God's love through Jesus Christ. The value of being a servant leader who relinquishes your prerogatives to advance the good of other people and to advance God's will. These are the values that God says will determine who's great in his kingdom when Christ returns. And many first will be last. And many last will be first. Success is not comparing yourself with other Christians in God's service. And I think a lot of us in this room who have met Christ and who have given our lives to fulfill his purpose, to be a light for Christ, we get tripped up. I know I do. We get tripped up right at this point because we begin to compare our role in God's work with other people. And we do that. It's easy to do this, frankly, for me at least. I get lured into comparing myself to other Christians spiritually when I compare my strengths to other people's weaknesses. It's like, oh man, I know the Bible a lot better than them. Oh my, I can speak a lot better than that person. Oh my gosh, I've had a lot more experience than they have. We kind of almost unconsciously get lured into propping ourselves up by comparing our strengths to others' weaknesses. Of course, once you're in that comparative mindset, you're set up for a nice big fall when you begin to see other people's strengths compared to your weaknesses at that very same point. And you wind up being depressed needlessly when you should be grateful for them. You wind up on strike against God, convincing yourself that you can't do anything for God. And it's all because we've adopted a comparative attitude toward other servants of Christ. And Paul just says, you know what? Speaking as an apostle, a greatly gifted man, he says, we're not bold to class or compare ourselves with other Christian workers. But then speaking of a certain group, when they measure themselves with each other and compare themselves with themselves, they're without understanding. He said, that is folly. Because God has given us different roles and he's given us different resources to play different roles. And what matters is not how well I'm doing in any of those spiritual areas compared to any other Christian. What matters is what has God given me to do that I'm aware of, and how faithful am I being to use the resources that God has given me to be a light for Christ in the situations into which he's put me. That's all that matters. In the parable of the talents in Matthew 25, the master returns, and the one man who'd been entrusted with 5 talents of gold made 5 more talents. The other man had been entrusted with 10 talents of gold and invested it and made 10 more talents. So on the level of return on investment, the second man did twice as well as the first man. But the master gave them the exact same reward. Why? Because he alone knew what he'd entrusted to them, and because they'd been equally faithful in using his resources to advance his estate. That's God's way of reckoning success. And it's only going to be all real clear to us how this shakes out when we stand before Christ. But we at least need to begin to adopt that mindset now as we live our lives out as Christian workers. Well, I'd like to close up this teaching by having you listen to a friend of mine, Ishka Yari, who has had, in some ways, the misfortune of living in my shadow for a number of years. And so I wanted you to hear what he has to say about this issue.
I came to Gary's group back in 93. It was very intimidating. I felt like I did not have what it takes to really be able to compete with these guys the way that I saw it at first. I looked at him, I thought, it's real nice what God can do to somebody like that, but I really felt and I doubted that God can really change me in any kind of significant way like that. I would just find myself, for no apparent reason, would just find myself getting resentful at my friends, people that I was pretty close to, and things like that. And just would feel like tension in the relationship. And after spending some time praying about it and thinking about it, I would realize, oh, I'm jealous of how gifted this guy over here is and how gifted that person over there is, you know. Comparing myself to other people has been detrimental in my life. It's simply making me neurotically fearful of taking challenges or taking steps of faith where God's calling me to act. I'm driven by fears because I have this standard of perfection, and the perfection is made practical by looking at other people and seeing how they're doing it. And I always seem to pale in comparison. I don't feel at all comfortable in front of people, and doing that sort of outward decisive leadership is something that I'm not really gifted in, or I feel fiercely inadequate and things like that. I really want to please people. I really want to look good in other people's eyes. That's just something I think that I really wrestle with. God is calling me not to want to win the approval of other people, but instead win the approval of Him, of God Himself. I believe that that's the way that He's designed me and all of us, is to really get a deep sense of satisfaction and joy out of living to please Him. It gets corrupted by my flesh, and I start wanting to please the people around me. And then I always get frustrated because God never lets me have that satisfaction. But that's how it works for me, to have to teach a study group while Gary is there and seeing his little beady eyes. And he's got those beady eyes too, hawking over my teaching. And I'm thinking he's critiquing every word that comes out of my lips. And I need to be able to teach this as eloquently and as clearly as he does. Me having maybe a couple of years experience doing this and him having 47 years of experience doing this. Yeah, that fear was very real, and it still is real. And it's just a challenging thing to work through. One of the greatest things is just having a sense of freedom. Freedom to fail, freedom to try new things, freedom to take challenging steps of faith that might lead to failure, and knowing that it's okay, it doesn't matter, because my identity and my significance and who I am is not wrapped up in how I do. It's just wrapped up simply in being submissive and obedient to God. But just being willing and actually acting on the things that God's calling me to do. Now, that thing might fail. That thing might succeed, or oftentimes in my case, it actually fails. But I can still have a measure of satisfaction knowing that it's a success in my book, because I simply was willing to do what God called me to do. Oftentimes, before the meeting, I'll find myself in prayer to God, telling Him that, look, I'm not able to go and serve people tonight. I'm not able to go and be hospitable and to meet new people and to be warm and encourage and build up the body. But I pray that you work through me in spite of my condition to do these kinds of things. And more often than not, I leave that meeting late. You know, I'll stay late and just end up having a really great time, get into really great conversations with people. Either be encouraged by them in some way, or be able to say things to people that are meaningfully encouraging to them. When we are weak and unable to do things on our own, that the power of God can really be shown through us. Because in many ways, people see our weaknesses. And when they see us doing the things that we're unable to do, it gives glory to God, knowing that God is working through us to get the job done.
Well, Ish gave that interview a couple of years ago, and it was after going through a real dark time for him where I think he had to get this issue straight to go on in serving the Lord, and he did. And one of the ironic things to me listening to it now is I was just talking with a couple of people that are in the home group that he helps to lead, and in an unsolicited way, they were talking about what a privilege it was to be to have such an effective leader in their midst, in Ish. So, anyway, that's the comparison of Elijah and Elisha, and that concludes our series. Well, let's pray. God, thank you. Thank you so much that you exist. If you didn't exist, God, our lives could not have ultimate purpose. And thank you, Lord, that when you call us to bow before you as the creature bowing to the Creator, you're calling us to a life of meaning. And I just pray for each of us here this morning, including myself, Lord, that you will help us, like the man in the gospel said, increase our faith. Lord. Help us to believe that you have created us for a unique role in your purpose, that you call all of us to know you through your Son, Jesus Christ, and that you call all of us on this quest to be a light for Christ in this dark and broken world during this period of history before you come back again to establish your kingdom. Amen.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.